Session number 11744, Rule 7.
As I said, I think that they believed with any luck they'd lost me, but I tracked them down to where they were, and I found the house, and it was very pleasant too. I was as weak as a rat after this confounded diphtheria, and my father was tickled pink. He said, "Look over there. You see that bloke digging in his front garden? That's old Jack Marshall. He was a chief ERA with me when I was on a 3-year commission on London, going round the world. And he knew that backside anywhere. And you won't believe it, but his son goes to the same school as you, which was Raines Foundation in Harbour Square in Stepney, a hell of a long way from New Eltham. Now, Alan Marshall, the son, and I disliked each other intensely, until we sorted things out, and then we were really close friends. Did all sorts of things together. Now, Alan wanted to go to sea, which he did. He was an apprentice on a tanker, and he managed to break himself up one day by falling down a companionway, became a post office engineer, nice, comfortable, reserved occupation, as you can imagine. And he said, "Blast this," and joined the Air Force as a pilot. Now, he went to Australia, to South Africa, was treated marvellously. He learned to fly Halifaxes, he instructed on Halifaxes, and then he went on his first tour. He was married, had a daughter, and sort of got down to his driving and getting through his tour very nicely and comfortably. In the meantime, I was going on my way back to Holland for the Rhine crossing, and I had, I suppose, a dozen or so lorries to take across, and I was the convoy officer for it. I was a sergeant. I found out that the ship we were in at Tilbury wasn't sailing until midday tide. All the people that were driving the lorries with me were Londoners, so I said, "Look, if you vanish and don't come back, I'm a dead cert court martial case. Failing that, you vanish, and I want you here at the Cracker Sparrow Fart tomorrow morning." And everybody turned up. Thank goodness. But I went down to the local pub, rang the marshals to say, "How are you, and how's Alan?" And he'd been shot down the night before by a night fighter. I met some of his crew after the war, and you can imagine the terrible things that happen when a night fighter gets at you. Things catch fire, and you've got cannon shell whipping through all sorts of bits and pieces, and you have to think a bit fast. Alan did that. He got his crew out. I believe in my own heart that he and his flight engineer held the thing steady for long enough for them to get out. And I met his navigator after the war when he called on Mrs. Marshall, and he said that Alan probably put it down on the ground in one piece and was kicked to death by the local people, because they were shown his identity cards and one or two other things. He didn't know that he had a son on the way. It only just happened. We'd seen photographs of him as a pilot officer and as a flying officer, and you could watch his face getting steadily thinner and thinner as time went by. One's expectation of life wasn't really great as a pilot of any sort. But he was one of the ordinary people that did their stuff and got away with it. If air crew can ever be ordinary people. Interesting, but it's not a soul-shaking experience for anybody that doesn't know the sort of things that happen. You take Ladd, I was at college with, Ken Ladd's. Now, he was the impossible character. On his third tour as an air gunner, he don't last that long. He'd worked his way up to squadron leader, squadron gunnery officer. Squadron leader Ladd's, he pushed off to the Bay of Biscay on coastal command. I think his CO or his station commander were driving the thing. Nice new aeroplane, Halifax again, that you could turn by putting your hand out of the window and the thing would turn. It was so beautifully balanced. It had just that bit of extra range over anything else in the squadron. Now, Ken Ladd's was shot down by a submarine. I don't know the full story. Everybody's a bit quiet about it. You know, there I was, 30,000 feet. But I believe that they'd damaged the submarine. It stayed on the surface, damaged them badly, and they went round umpteen times and put it down, and then dropped into the Pawnee in the bay. An extraordinary crew. Their discipline was superb. They had morning prayers. They had to give lectures on subjects they interested them. They did PE by waving their arms and legs about. And although they had little hope of survival, they just carried on. Until, but purely fortuitously, a destroyer on its way back from the Mediterranean, where it had been badly damaged, was coming out into the Atlantic, far away from the coast, because he wasn't in really in fit condition to fight enemy aircraft, spotted them. How on earth he did it, God knows. But he did, and picked them up, and they all survived. Now, Ken Ladd's became a headmaster a bit quickly, you can imagine. But when he went up for his interview with people who said, why do you want to become a teacher? His cry was, well, I've got a duodenal ulcer growing up, and teaching's the only job that I know that I can get 6 weeks off to have it sorted out comfortably. He used to come along home. My father had had a duodenal ulcer operation at that time, and they used to call each other the gastric wrecks, and that was that. Ordinary people or bold heroes. Who can tell the difference? When Ken Ladd's and I were learning to become teachers, we went to one of these emergency training places, and a more ram-sammy place you've never run across. There, I think there were two people who hadn't been in the services. Now, by sheer chance, Ken Ladd's lived in a little bedroom study affair immediately opposite me. Next door to both of us were army people, and we were chuntering away with our feet up on the head of our beds, you know, sort of flat on our backs, thinking beautiful thoughts. And for some reason, the army found it very, very fascinating and interesting. It was a queer sort of college altogether. Johnny Negus, who used to drive a frigate across the North Atlantic. Chap called Soper, who was a wing commander, who used to fly his Spitfires to Berlin and back to take photographs. All sorts of odd combined operations people, commando people, all sorts, sizes and descriptions. One-legged baker who'd been shot up a bit at Arnhem. Oh, you name it, we got one of them. But at any rate, I was chuntering away happily, talking about the intrepid, wonderful-sighted birdmen who could see anything, you know, the usual cry upstairs. And I was saying that I'd been up one morning doing a practice in deception with somebody else. The usual funny things, our controller said, gave us courses to chase the chap who was acting as our target. He got to the street where he said punch, which meant really sort of get your AI's gear interested. We yelled back Judy, which meant that we got something on it. Then we cried contact, which meant we got a firm blip that we were chasing. And, of course, at that time, everybody shut up because I was busy talking to my pilot, giving him up, down a bit, turn port 2 degrees and that sort of thing. And he was busy looking out of the front end to see where his target was. And the next thing was tally-ho, which meant that I could lie back and relax in my little office chair. And I took no further interest in it for a moment until my pilot, he was an ex-hurricane pilot, suddenly said, "Well, can you see him? Where is he?" And there I was in the back of this damned havoc, peering about all over the sky, trying to find our playmate, the chap who was acting as target. And could I see him? Could I help? Nowadays, everybody goes out to the Costa del Crime, or wherever one goes to, by aeroplane, and one knows all about the beautiful castles that you cross as you go over the sparkling white clouds. You see the pretty shapes of the aeroplane underneath you, sort of coming along as a rainbow. You look down through breaks in the cloud, and you see the lovely crocheted edge of a deep blue sea. It looks absolutely superb. Well, you know, you've all seen it. You see the little ships going along, like tadpoles with a glowing white wake behind them. All wonderful things. But those days it was sort of strange, and it came to but few of us. Any rate, I looked and I looked and I looked, and for about 4 minutes I couldn't find him. And sort of cursing away at my driver and saying, "No, I haven't got him." And I looked round just over my left shoulder, and there he was with his starboard wing tucked in, more or less touching me, our port wing and elevator. And he'd been sitting there for about 3 minutes, and I couldn't see him. As I say, these intrepid birdmen with wonderful eyesight. Now, I've told you about Ken Ladd's. He was a highly experienced air gunner, and they were bobbing about in the bay, or over the bay once, lots and lots of room, marvellous visibility, but one of those soft, blurry sort of days. No real cloud, but mist in all directions, and over there somebody saw an aircraft, and they got down to it, arguing gently about the thing. Two people identified it as a bow fighter. Somebody else said, "Bow fighter be blowed, that's a Liberator." Three other people swore that it was a Condor, you know, those enormous German aircraft that used to stay up for about 25 hours and chase convoys about. And as a general run of things, they all decided in the end that it must be a Condor. Let's go and go for it. Reminds you of the old days when you had Nelson's frigates and things. Suddenly you'd see a sail on the horizon. You double shot your guns, you drag them out, you go up to windward and try and bear down on the chap from upwind. And you'd fight until sufficient of you were killed, and then you sort of overcame the enemy. Well, having decided it was a Condor, they decided to go and fight it. Now, that's the difference between that lot and me. I'd have run like blazes, so would most civilized people. But they got their guns out and they got everything ready, and they went over to look closely at this Condor, this bow fighter, this Liberator, this whatever it was. Do you know what it was? It was a Red Cross ship on its way back, bringing wounded back from the Mediterranean. And literally, there it was, chugging along in a calm sea, and everybody was identifying it as an aircraft, which only goes to show something, doesn't it? If you can endure it. I'm going back to sort of prehistory times in 38, 39, when we played tennis and rugby and all sorts of silly games. And I belonged to a tennis club that cost us 30 bob a year, and out of that the club paid for tennis balls. We made up any deficiencies by running dances. We were none of us terribly good at tennis, but we had a collection of odds and ends there. I've been nattering about bold heroes and ordinary people in wartime. My wife was a member. Now, if anybody was a bold hero, she was. She lived in Eltham, which is very close to Woolwich Arsenal, was an obvious target. She and her parents had a hell of a time. You know, sort of rations were difficult, food was difficult, they were always fed. She had younger brothers. No, it was all very difficult, and when she went to work in the Arsenal, I was terrified in case the opposition dropped bombs on the place, and it wasn't the safest life or anything else. Out of the rest of us, there was Alan Marshall, who, as I say, got shot down in a Halifax. There was Ken Runcorn, who was the luckiest chap I've ever known. He wanted to join the Civil Air Guard to learn to fly before the war. You learnt to fly for nothing, and then you were expected to join the Air Force on the reserve if war broke out. Well, Ken went up for his medical and found that he'd got a very slight hernia. So he went off to have it sorted out. There were no great waiting lists in those days. I don't quite know how it works. And in the meantime, he bought himself one of the old Jap engined Morgans. Terribly fast, very uncomfortable, very fine thing to drive. And Ken used to work up in Kingsway, Ericsson Telephones. Ideal place to work because he used to get us all up to Wimbledon for nothing so that we could watch the tennis up there. He went up there one Saturday morning to make sure that we could get our tickets for Wimbledon. Went to start his Morgan, was still a bit weak after his operation for hernia, put his large brogue boot on the starting handle, kicked it across. The Morgan promptly kicked him across Kingsway because he'd forgotten to retard the ignition. And Ken came back to Eltham, and we were playing a tennis match that afternoon. He wasn't playing because he was still a bit poorly. And we had a look at his foot, and this enormous brogue, you know, a really big thing, a church's or something, was split right across the sole. So we took him off to hospital, and he'd broken about 3 bones in his foot. When he learnt to fly, somewhere near Oxford, I think, he was trying to put the fear of God into the odd bargee on the canal there, forgot what he was doing, took the wings off his tiger moth on the trees beside the canal, and walked away from that one. He became a service policeman for several days. He then took up an air gunner, off the Isle of Man somewhere, in a Blenheim, and the hydraulics went wrong, and the thing was awash in hydraulic oil. One of his air gunners sort of picked up his parachute by the ripcord, so he had a cockpit full of oil and full of silk, and Ken landed that and got away with it. And yet on his very first operational trip, he must have run across an Ack-Ack ship somewhere across by the Dutch Islands that put an Ack-Ack shell through his aircraft, and that was the last anybody heard of Ken, which doesn't sound possible at all, does it? There was Dennis Spencer, red-headed and mad, who was bone idle. He was obviously nobody's fool. His father was accountant to a big asbestos company. Mother was a school teacher. And then, quite suddenly, Dennis decided that he wanted to go to Cranwell. Well, getting into Cranwell pre-war was rather like getting into the Kingdom of Heaven. You had to have influence and lots of other things. So old Dennis settled down and worked. I've never known anybody work like it. He also had a very slight squint, which he had sorted out at the Royal Eye Hospital. He passed for Cranwell. He passed the medical. He got to Cranwell. And after he'd been there for about 3 weeks, he had one more medical and failed it on his squint. And he got thrown out of the Air Force. There was only one thing to do in the Air Force in those days, and that was to fly. who the devil wanted to be an accounting officer. So old Dennis finally got called up, because he must have been sort of one of the first conscript people. He went in as a private, quite obviously. He was one of the Dunkirk Harriers, you know, sort of nipped back through Dunkirk. He was in one of the RAMC, in the Medical Corps, or the Army Service Corps, or something like that. Having got back to England, he was promptly shunted out to the Western Desert. He ran up and down the desert. You know, you come this way with the Italians, you go that way with the Germans, and ultimately you come this way, finally, for good with Montgomery, and you come into Italy, where Dennis went, and I don't think he went to Normandy, but he did everything else. And he came out as a nice new private, just as he went in as a private. There was another lad, Grant, Bert Grant. Now, he was a grease monkey in the local garage. He used to grease your car when it went in for service. And he got called into the army, went in as a private. And he had rather a dicey sort of job. He was an expert at dismantling mines. There are people that survive it, and so did Bert. He did, all the way through, God knows how. You know, there he was in Antwerp, and places like that, and Cherbourg, sorting out that which the Germans had left behind to discourage us. Now, years before the war, when we used to do amateur dramatics, and when I was in the Rover Scouts, and so was Alan, so was Dennis Vincer, so was Bert Grant. He'd met a very fine girl called Maudie something or another, and they were both mad keen sunbathers and mad keen open air enthusiasts. They were camping enthusiasts. Well, obviously, we were rovers, but they loved this open air nonsense. And Maudie went into the services, and she was the youngest and smallest sergeant major that ever happened. And Bert married her, and quite obviously he achieved the average common private soldier's delight. You can imagine, can't you, marrying a sergeant major? But at any rate, after the war, he decided that there was no future in sort of greasing cars for hitches up in Eltham. So he bought a bungalow down in West Kingstown. He became an estate agent, made a fortune. He said it was a wonderful job. He used to sit in the garden thinking beautiful thoughts, and every now and again he'd dig a bit of garden and plant a few potatoes, and Maudie answered the telephone, and she'd sell a couple of houses, and they'd live on the proceeds. He retired at about 55 down to Poole, still going strong. He's got a youngster now in the Royal Marines. You know, he's one of the real special boats, parachutists, captain this or that. Marvellous chaps. I must get hold of him soon and find out what the Gulf War was really like. Then there was Bill Sully, who unfortunately died of a heart attack just recently. A nice little lad, nowhere near my size, tiny bloke. Now, he also went into the army, and he landed on D-Day with the British forces. I was fool enough to land with the Americans. Now, old Bill Sully was in the same boxing team that I was when we were in the Scouts together. There was a lot of me. You could hit me much more easily than Bill, because if you looked at him stripped down for the ring, there was a large head, two enormous leather gloves, and that was about all you could see, that and a pair of elbows. And you try sort of opening him up with a tin opener. It was a hell of a job. But he was very vexed, because he'd done everything possible. He was the CO's batman. And he landed in Normandy with his water bottle full of whiskey. Very fine stuff, because he said, you never know when you need it. And the first thing that happened to Bill was that somebody pushed a rifle bullet through it from one end to the other, and he lost the lot. He's very cross about that. Anyway, he survived until fairly recently, and that was that. Why am I saying all this stuff? Just that it was an odd time before the war. There were all these people who suddenly became soldiers, airmen, sailors, like Fred Daly, who became a sailor, a more unlikely sailor you can't imagine. But at my wedding, there was Fred Daly with a grin all over his face and DSM up on his chest. I don't know whether he'd shot the cook or saved the cook, but one of the two. I suppose that in those days we must have been a very unsophisticated lot. Whether we believed all the propaganda that we heard about Poland and Czechoslovakia and stuff, I don't know. I do know that we had a very nice youngster came to stay in England in about 38 from Czechoslovakia, and I'd love to hear from him once more, but he gave my wife a beautiful book about puppies by a Czechoslovakian character, and I suppose that from him we learnt a bit of the horrors of Nazism and stuff. I know I thoroughly enjoyed holidays in Germany before the war. You'd gallop around, they were all very friendly people. You'd go to youth hostels and everybody patted you on the back and said, you know, we're brothers under the skin and all that sort of stuff. Don't believe them now, do you? Particularly after I've been in Belsen.